Thank you, everyone. What an honor to be here tonight. In all the years of the Family Institute of Connecticut's history, and we just celebrated our 20th anniversary just last year, in all those years, never before tonight has there been an occasion where a separate organization put on an event for the benefit of the Family Institute of Connecticut. Thank you so much. And it doesn't surprise me at all that the first time ever that that would happen, that it would be the Knights of Columbus. Thank you. Before I forget, and I will forget, but I know that Larry, our Director of Operations, is here and he'll have my head if I forget this. We do have packets at the table by the door. If you can, please, if you're not familiar with us or you are not yet on our email list or our mailing list, please grab one of those packets and sign your name if we have name sheets over there. So, as I said, it doesn't surprise me that the first organization that would do this for us would be the Knights of Columbus, because the Knights of Columbus have been there all along. I came up in this movement through the Knights of Columbus. I'm here tonight, and I hold the position that I do at the Family Institute, and in those larger battles in the state of Connecticut that you heard in the introduction, specifically because of the Knights of Columbus. But for the KFC, a lot of those victories that we've won, a lot of the battles that we fought, would not have happened at all. We would not be in this fight at all if it wasn't for the Knights of Columbus, who have been the partner of the Family Institute throughout this decade. I joined the Knights when I was 26 years old. I'm 40 now. So it's been a big chunk of my adult life. But I joined the Knights when I was 26 years old. And I was attracted to the Knights of Columbus specifically because there's something about the Knights. The Knights fill this niche that no other organization does. And I'll tell you, I in my role as the head of the Family Institute, we're an ecumenical, we're a non-sectarian organization, and I speak to people from every walk of life. I speak to various Protestant groups, various Catholic groups, but whenever I speak to the Knights of Columbus, it's like I'm coming home, because this is where it all began for me. When I joined the Knights at the age of 26, the thing that attracted to me, the niche that the Knights filled, was that no other organization plays this role where patriotism, and because we're here in the United States of America, I'm speaking specifically about American patriotism. Patriotism, love of this wonderful country that has been so blessed by God, patriotism and Catholicism overlap nowhere as they do with the Knights of Columbus. That was the attraction to me. You heard a reference to my children's names. You heard their first names. What I'd like you to know, if you haven't heard this story, is that all five of my children are named specifically after American saints, where we took the saint's last name and made it our child's middle name. So the full names of all my, of course, all their last names are Wolfgang. The full names of all my children are Elizabeth Seaton, Catherine Drexel, Isaac Jobes, Rose Duchenne, and Francis Cabrini. That's my, you know, everyone has their own particular spirituality, but that's mine. Mine is love of country and love of God. You know, see, I think the American Legion maybe has that slogan for God and country. And with always, of course, God being first and country second. But that has been the motivating factor throughout my adult life and for all the things that I do. And the first place I went to live that out was the Knights of Columbus, because no one represents that better in America than the Knights of Columbus. So I joined when I was 26. And of course, you heard reference to the petition drive. And, you know, the other thing, too, that needs to be said about the Knights is patriotism, the Knights is love of country, but the Knights are also about fighting anti-Catholicism. And the Knights were founded here in the state of Connecticut. I mean, we were always an immigrant people here in the United States of America, and we were always a people very much under siege, and in some ways we still are to this day, and I'll talk about that. But you know, it's interesting, there was, just in the last couple of years, there was a book that was published, a biography, about our founder, Father McGivney, the Knights founder, who of course is from here in Connecticut, and may, God willing, become the first canonized saint from the state of Connecticut. This book, Parish Priest, I'm struck by the first line. I memorized it. The very first line in the biography of Father McGivney, Parish Priest, the line is, "Not that Connecticut had anything against Catholics in the early 1800s, but they weren't allowed to purchase property." And that's how the book starts. And of course, it goes on to tell the story of Father McGivney and the founding of the Knights of Columbus in New Haven in the late 1800s and so forth. But I'll tell you, I mean, of course, today we're allowed to purchase property, but I'm struck by how much those themes from the life of Father McGivney continue right into the 21st century, right into the battles that we're fighting right here in the founder's state, and the extent to which the elite establishments of our state are still telling us, "You're outsiders. You don't really belong here. You Italians, you Irish, you Polish, you Catholics. You're welcome to stay here as long as you play by our rules. But don't forget who's in charge." That's what this battle in Enfield is really all about. That's what last year's battle on SB 1098, the bishop removal bill, was all about. And that's what so many of the fights that we're having these days are all about. So, how did we get to where we are now? Well, I can speak specifically about this last decade or so. You heard reference to the fact that I used to be a district deputy for the Knights of Columbus. That's an interesting story. I was, I joined the Knights when I was 26, and it was all still very new to me. I didn't know a lot about the inner workings of the Knights, and one day I got a call from the state deputy at the time, Mike Rinaldi, and he said, "Would you like to be a district deputy?" I was living up in the northwest corner of the state of Connecticut. And I said, "Sure, I'll be a district deputy." "What's a district deputy?" Boy, you know, you learn when you jump in there. So I skipped right over Grand Night and went straight to district deputy and plunged right in. And it was during that time, you know, I've got some great stories like that. Last year when we were fighting, actually it wasn't 1098, it was the other thing, 899, the codification of the gay marriage bill. I was invited to come down to Supreme Headquarters in New Haven. And I was expecting to meet with some of these middle management folks that I had been coordinating with to put in a clause to protect religious liberty. So I went in, and that was all I was told ahead of time. I'd be meeting with my usual contacts. So I went in to meet with them, and they, as soon as they saw me, they said, "Okay, good, grab your stuff. Carl's waiting for you in his office." That's, you know, it's always been, it's full of wonderful surprises when you're fighting for the truth in Connecticut here for the Knights of Columbus as well. So I was a district deputy, and what happened was the same-sex marriage issue exploded on us here in Connecticut. These things started, as they always do, not with us. We're not the cultural aggressors here. We're usually playing defense. We're usually the ones just trying to protect our faith and our country as we've known it. But as usual, a group of radical activists funded by a national movement from out of the state of Connecticut had targeted our state and decided, in these early years of the 2000s, the courts in Massachusetts had already imposed same-sex marriage. But that wasn't good enough for the national gay marriage movement. They knew that in the eyes of so many people, this wasn't a legitimate victory. This was a handful of our black-robed masters, basically, as with the abortion issue on the national level with Roe v. Wade, that you had a handful of judges just sort of acting as your philosopher kings, you know, making all the big decisions for the little people. And so the same-sex marriage ruling in Massachusetts was really not that, it was a victory, but it wasn't the victory the gay marriage movement really wanted. They wanted a legislative victory. They wanted a democratic victory. And they targeted Connecticut because we have a legislature so heavily gerrymandered that it's to the left of the state itself. And there's such a weak culture of democratic accountability in the state of Connecticut, unfortunately, that they thought it would be an easy, soft target. This would be the place where they could get same-sex marriage through the legislature for the first time. Well, we showed them otherwise, and it was the Knights of Columbus who did it. The partnership between the Knights of Columbus and the Family Institute of Connecticut in the early 2000s generated 100,000 signatures for the defense of marriage. I firmly believe to this day that it's because of that petition drive that they never could get same-sex marriage through the legislature. And as many of you know, a couple years later, we had this giant rally on a freezing cold day, 6,000 people, and a series of events like that, and none of it would have happened, I firmly believe, without the key role that the Knights of Columbus played. And of course, what happened was we stopped same-sex marriage at the legislature. We even got the legislature to explicitly define marriage as between a man and a woman. And then the same thing as Massachusetts, the same thing as Roe v. Wade with abortion on the national level. A 4-3 ruling by the court, one judge who wasn't even a Supreme Court justice, redefined marriage for the entire state of Connecticut. And even that wasn't the end of the story. You heard me make reference to SB 899 when I was visiting the Supreme and I was asked to come into Carl Anderson's office. Funny thing too, side note about our Supreme Knight. When one of the legislators heard that I had a meeting in the Supreme Knight's office, he said to me, "Wow, you know, what must that have been like? There must have been pictures all over the walls of him meeting with various presidents and popes and stuff." I don't know if any of you have ever been in Mr. Anderson's office, but I was struck. It didn't occur to me until I had that question. What I remember is there were two icons of Christ. I don't think there was a single picture in his office of him meeting with lesser important people. And I think that says a lot about our Supreme Knight and the kind of the good man that he is. We're very lucky to be led by him in our order. He's been an inspiration to me in a lot of the work that I do. But anyway, even after the court imposed same-sex marriage, we were able, the Family Institute put out full-page ads for a week in a row, generating 20,000 phone calls to the state legislature, forcing the state legislature to enact the strongest guarantees of religious liberty against same-sex marriage in the entire nation. We're now in a situation where Connecticut, religious churches and other religious organizations in the state of Connecticut actually have stronger liberties than they do in Massachusetts. You've heard the stories, Catholic Charities in Boston forced out of providing adoptions, a Methodist church in New Jersey that lost tax-exempt status over its beachfront pavilion, a Knights of Columbus Hall up in British Columbia that was sued. Those religious liberty guarantees, and of course there's always the possibility that these things will be tested in court, but the experts tell us that these are the strongest guarantees in the entire country against same-sex marriage. We couldn't have done that without the Knights of Columbus. I mean, Family Institute, we partnered with Knights of Columbus all the way from the petition drive through the attempt to get a constitutional convention in 2008 right up to those religious liberty fights that we had in 2009. Never would have happened without the Knights of Columbus. Family Institute, of course, we're in the arena, we're your folks on the ground, and we have this fearsome reputation among our opponents and in the legislature and in the media, but at the end of the day, we're actually a small two-man office. And if it wasn't for the love and support and prayers of organizations like the Knights of Columbus, there's no way we would have been able to accomplish these things. So I can't say enough about how grateful we are that the Knights of Columbus, you know, it truly is the strong right arm of the church. And in these battles, the right arm of the church flexed hard here in the state of Connecticut. And I think in the course of these battles over these last 10 years, we've been putting the word knight back into the Knights of Columbus. We've been fighting mad and fighting back and letting the state of Connecticut know we're still here. And we're not going to take this. We're going to push back. Which, of course, brings us to the topic of SB 1098, doesn't it? SB 1098, I like to call it the Bishop Removal Bill. This was a bill that popped up a year ago in 2009. after the great same-sex marriage battles of 2008, we had a court, recall in 2008, we had a court in California impose same-sex marriage on that state. We had our own court here in Connecticut impose same-sex marriage on our state. The Knights of Columbus in the Catholic Church generally, and of course the Family Institute, I mean, we were involved in all these battles. The Knights is an international order, but of course they're headquartered here in Connecticut in New Haven. And the Knights in New Haven, the Supreme, sent about $1 million over to California, more than $1 million, I think, to fight the successful battle to pass Proposition 8 and overturn the same-sex marriage ruling in California. And of course, here in Connecticut, everyone knows the Knights of Columbus and Family Institute partner closely, and they, you know, everyone at the legislature certainly remembers the petition drive of 2002-2003. And so we weren't able to, we didn't have the same direct initiative law that they were able to put to such good use in California or more recently in Maine. All we had was this constitutional convention question, and we fought hard for that, and it didn't happen. But then rolling into 2009, what happened was our biggest opponents at the state legislature, the co-chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Mr. Lawler and McDonald, they wanted revenge. That's what SB 1098 was about. And please understand, when I say that that's what SB 1098 was about, it's not just me saying it. Senator Michael McLaughlin, who is a Republican from Danbury, who serves on the Judiciary Committee, those were his words in public statements. When SB 1098 was introduced, McLaughlin very clearly called it payback against Lawler and McDonald's payback against the Catholic Church for their opposition to same-sex marriage. They were hopping mad over that $1 million that got sent to California. They were hopping mad over that petition drive from 8 years earlier. And they finally got what they wanted through a 4-3 decision of the state's highest court, and now it was time for payback, as Senator McLaughlin said. That's what that bill was about. And even when we rose up about, I think one of the Catholic papers put it at about 4,500 people, and the Family Institute was involved, and it was a strong leadership, particularly from the Diocese of Bridgeport, to make that rally happen. 4,500 people in the space of a few days showed up on a Wednesday, on a weekday, all took the time off from work to come and fight that bill. And I mean, there was actually, they pulled the bill. We probably would have had even more people there, but you had that 4,500 people rise up, the bill gets pulled, and then all of a sudden, very briefly, Lawler and McDonald schedule a hearing on an assisted suicide bill. Do you remember that? These guys still hadn't learned their lesson. Well, everyone was still very upset over SB 1098. Everyone was all still mobilized, so we started to work against the assisted suicide bill right away. That got pulled immediately. And McLaughlin again took to his public forums, and McLaughlin said that Lawler and McDonald, what the assisted suicide thing was all about, was Lawler and McDonald were pursuing, and these are McLaughlin's words, a personal vendetta against the church. That's what this was about. It was payback. SB 1098 was payback to the Catholic Church for its opposition to same-sex marriage. Now that it's been imposed by the court, we are now in a season of payback, and it's not going to stop. Because you see, I mean, never before had our opponents at the legislature been slapped down as hard as they were in the matter of SB 1098, Bishop Removal Bill. And even then, they tried to squeeze some sort of revenge out of that with the brief scheduling of the assisted suicide bill. Personal vendetta. Personal vendetta. But we fought back against it. We fought back, we defeated it, and because of the leadership of the Knights of Columbus and the Diocese of Bridgeport and the Family Institute and others, I mean, for the first time in a long time, the legislature realized that, no, Catholics are still here, they're still an active presence, and they have something to say. And that brings us up to the battle that we're fighting this year in 2010. You heard a reference in the introduction to Enfield. Let's talk for a few minutes about what Enfield means, what that battle is about, and how it relates to everything that I already talked about. Because even though at the heart of Enfield, of that battle, is a Baptist church, it really ties into this whole storyline of that the Knights of Columbus has experienced throughout its entire history of a sort of prejudice against people of faith here in the state of Connecticut, including sometimes particularly of people of Catholic faith. The ACLU, you're all familiar with the ACLU, I'm sure. The ACLU sent a threatening letter to about five towns in the Hartford area. These five towns had been holding their public high school graduations at First Cathedral in Bloomfield, which is a Baptist mega church. And this letter threatened to sue them. And of course, that letter carries an unspoken, not just a spoken legal threat, but also an unspoken financial threat, because it costs a lot of money to defend yourself against a lawsuit. That's why people tend to cave when they get a threatening letter from the ACLU. The ACLU sent around a threatening letter saying, holding your high school graduations at First Cathedral is a violation of the separation of church and state. And if you continue this, we're going to sue you. Now, I should back up and I should say that First Cathedral, this Baptist church, is headed by a Baptist minister named Archbishop Leroy Bailey. Archbishop Bailey is a close friend of the Family Institute of Connecticut. And Archbishop Bailey has been attacked by our opponents before. He's African American. He was the keynote speaker for the Martin Luther King Day in West Hartford about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And the pro-same-sex marriage movement went at him in the town of West Hartford vociferously because he was their speaker. And it seemed to us like what was happening at First Cathedral was a continuation of what we saw last year with SB 1098. It is still a season of payback. It is still about personal vendetta. Right away, I mean, with a full head of steam coming off of the Kerrigan case imposing same-sex marriage and the failure of the Constitutional Convention, our opponents at the legislature wanted revenge, and they went at the biggest target in sight, the Catholic Church. And boy, did they get a black eye. You know, they failed. They couldn't get the Catholics. And I think what they saw was, okay, we couldn't get the Catholics. Who else can we get? Who's a smaller target that maybe we can take out? And I think that's why they targeted this Baptist minister in his church in the town of Bloomfield. So Family Institute took an interest. And all five of these towns had caved in. Well, we got a lot of calls in our office. I mean, we got some from all of those towns. But in particular, one town, Enfield, we had a lot of members in Enfield. And they were calling us and asking for our help. So what we did is we arranged with ACLJ, American Center for Law and Justice, to represent the town of Enfield if Enfield should change its mind and stand up to the ACLU. We put the ACLJ and First Cathedral and Enfield's Board of Education all into conversation with each other. These three parties had not been talking to one another. So we put them all together. We arranged for ACLJ's legal services are free in cases like this. We arranged for free legal counsel for the town of Enfield. We worked with the Enfield Board of Ed, and we got the Enfield Board of Ed to reverse its decision and to stand up to the ACLU. And I think you all know what happened since. The ACLU made good on its legal threat. They filed suit against the town of Enfield. They moved for a preliminary motion to block even the graduation happening just a few weeks from now. I mean, this is just mean-spirited. I mean, it's the case would have worked itself out one way or another, but they really wanted to punish those kids. And this battle in Enfield began with the kids. The kids were involved before Family Institute was. And the ACLU wanted to make sure that everyone gets the word, you don't mess with the ACLU. You know, part of what inspired me to take up that battle in Enfield, I mean, some of you may know my history. I'm a political conservative today, but I used to be a man of the left. And in my second year at UConn Law School, I did some volunteer work for the ACLU. Actually, for this project I'm about to mention, they paid me. I actually ghost wrote one of those threatening letters from the ACLU when I was in my second year of law school. Got the entire prison system in the state of Connecticut to change its policy regarding how they treat visitors. because of work I did. I did the research, they paid me, I wrote the letter, and the entire prison system in Connecticut changed the policy. So, you know, having been on the other side, I knew that it was probably some other second year law student that wrote this letter. Schools and the schools all collapsed, and we provided the means to stand up to the school, to stand up to the ACLU. And the schools did. The schools stood up. ACLU made good on its threat. They filed a preliminary motion. A U.S. district judge, Judge Janet Hall, granted the motion, and this is now on appeal. But what was striking about Judge Hall's motion, well, a lot of things were, but what was particularly striking, and this is what I think brings us full circle back to Father McGivney, is Judge Hall bought the ACLU's line that one reason why this whole thing, Enfield holding their graduation at First Cathedral, is illegitimate, are you ready for this, is because I was involved, because the Family Institute of Connecticut was involved. The ACLU concocted this theory that the chairman of the Board of Education, who is himself a minister, that he and I were in some sort of nefarious Christian conspiracy to foist religion on these kids. You may ask, you know, why would you, Peter Wolfgang, a Catholic, be in the business of foisting the Baptist religion on Enfield? But, you know, that would be logical, and there wasn't a lot that was logical about this decision. It would be logical to ask that question. But Judge Janet Hall's decision, you know, it's very interesting. She said that it was an endorsement of religion just to hold the graduation at the high school. And endorsement of religion, she quoted an earlier case that said that it's something that conveys to non-adherents of a religion that they are not full members of the political community, that they are outsiders, and that believers are full members, that they are insiders. Well, that's exactly what Judge Janet Hall's decision said about me and about the Family Institute and about our members and about all of you who share our values. I mean, just to not be able to hold a high school graduation at a church, calling that an endorsement of religion, well, that's silly enough. But to say specifically that because the Family Institute lobbied on this, because we were involved in this, that somehow makes this whole thing tainted, this whole thing illegitimate, it all circles around back to that first line in Parish Priest. Not that the state of Connecticut had anything against Catholics in the early 1800s, but they weren't allowed to purchase property. Not that the state of Connecticut has anything against Catholics in the early 21st century, but they're not full participants in the political process. They're allowed to be part of the state of Connecticut as long as they know their place, as long as they know how things work here, as long as they know who's in charge. Who's in charge? Well, the ACLU's in charge. Americans United for the Separation of Church and State are in charge. Judge Janet Hall is in charge. The Hartford Courant is in charge. Those are the people who are in charge, and it's your job to sing to their tune. And if you don't, if you rock the boat, we will bury you. That is the message that has been sent to all of us in these last few weeks since Judge Janet Hall's decision has come down. And I think our role, and we've been doing it increasingly these last 10 years or so in the state of Connecticut, our role is to educate these folks that, no, as a matter of fact, and it comes back again to what attracted me to the Knights of Columbus to begin with, patriotism, love of country, belonging here. And I think it's going to be a painful lesson for our opponents. Right now they're very excited about Judge Janet Hall's ruling, but this has a long way to go. And I think my hope is that in the process, we'll be educating some of our self-appointed betters, these elite establishment types here in the state of Connecticut, who are not half as sophisticated as they think they are. And we're going to be teaching them that, no, as a matter of fact, we belong here too. This is our country too. And contrary to the message that Judge Janet Hall sent to us, we are full members of the political community. We are insiders. We are as much inside as you are or anyone else is. And we're going to be exercising our rights as free, full citizens in a democratic republic. And, well, if you don't like that, well, it's time for you to realize that that's democracy, that's representative government, and we have a right to have a say too. That's what this is all about. people need to know that, yes, as a matter of fact, Catholics belong here too. People of other religious faith belong here too. It's not a case that we're somehow lesser citizens, that we're somehow not full members of the political community. That's what this has all been about. I mean, the same-sex marriage thing, the abortion thing, obviously they're about same-sex marriage and they're about abortion, but they're also about telling you that you're not in charge around here. You're not full members of the community. That's what we've been fighting since the days of Father McGivney, when Connecticut, not that it had anything against Catholics, we weren't even allowed to purchase property here. And now the same state and its same elite institutions are telling us, not that we have anything against you Catholics, but you're not allowed to be full participants in the political process. If you get involved in these issues and you prevail, well, that can't be allowed. We'll have to yank that victory from you. So we're going to continue on the way we have, in the spirit of Father McGivney, in the spirit of Pope John Paul II, in the spirit of the five saints indigenous to the United States that I named my children after. And we are going to let them know that, yes, we are here, and we're fully Catholic, and we're fully American, and the country is a better place because of it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.